You're listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc Series. We are broadcasting from the ancestral, unceded territory of the Hukkaminam-speaking Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. In the last year, CITR has been digitizing our collection of reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes containing an archive of audio broadcast on UBC's campus and community radio station from 1949 to the late 90s. With help from the UBC University Archives and the UBC Library Digitization Center, 400 audio files are now available for the public to listen and download, with more on the way. To share this history, we have made a series of documentaries produced by students and community broadcasters. This project is funded by UBC's Centennial Initiative Fund, celebrating a century of success at UBC. Tune in every Thursday at 4 p.m. for the next 4 weeks from January 14th to February 4th for a new documentary. And visit our website, citr.ca/docs, for podcasts, interviews with the producers, and more information.
April 27th, 1986. Vancouver, BC. Over 115,000 people march from Burrard Bridge to BC Place Stadium in the Vancouver Walk for Peace. People hold up large banners that say phrases like Stop Star Wars and End the Arms Race in bold capital letters. The Vancouver Walk for Peace was an annual peace march advocating for the end of nuclear arms buildup. It began in 1982, but by 1986 became the largest annual peace event in the entirety of North America. The audio you are hearing in the background right now comes from video footage of the 30th anniversary of the Vancouver Walk for Peace.
And roar even more, let's put an end to war.
Vancouver was not alone in holding peace marches during the 1980s, though. The Great Peace March for Global Nuclear Disarmament in November 1986 was another notable peace advocacy event promoting the elimination of nuclear weapons. It consisted of hundreds of people marching from Los Angeles, California, all the way to Washington, D.C.
We are marching from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. Our goal is to take a message to the leaders of the world that we want to take down nuclear weapons in the world.
Sentiments to put an end to the arms race during the 1980s were echoed by people all over the world, in countries like Australia and Norway. These sentiments, whether in the form of marches, rallies, or protests, to put an end to the nuclear age, amalgamates into what we now call the peace movement of the 1980s. My name is Christine Kim, and you are listening to The Peace Movement, the beginning and end of nuclear disarmament campaigning in Vancouver, a documentary produced for CITR's An Audio Evolution of UBC.
Try to make it real, but compared to what? Set the president.
Despite the peace movement having been a popular advocacy campaign in North America and other parts of the Western world, it is a curious fact that the sentiments behind the movement have dissipated dramatically since the end of the Cold War. Curious, because nuclear weapons still exist to this day, and there are still enough of them to destroy every living thing on the planet. Today, the fervor behind getting rid of nuclear arms, programs, and research is no more. No longer do we see or hear about political activist groups vying for nuclear disarmament. No longer are the horrors of the aftermath of a nuclear apocalypse or nuclear winter known or talked about among the general public. What was a determined and serious campaign for the end of all nuclear weapons has tacitly become an almost non-existent concern to some, and nothing more than a distant memory of something long past to others. But why? Why did the peace movement in Vancouver falter and die so silently and steadily away from the minds of the general public conscience? What happened? To answer this question, I begin by exploring what drove the peace movement in the first place. For that, we turn to the historical context in which this campaign thrived. Part 1. Motivations behind the peace movement. The 1980s was a decade in history marked by renewed acts of aggression between the U.S. and the USSR. After a hopeful thawing of relations between the two major superpowers in the 1970s, the Cold War strayed suddenly and rapidly from its previous course of détente. There were many catalytic events that propelled the sudden shift, not the least of which includes the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979 and the inauguration of Ronald Reagan as the 40th President of the United States of America.
So at that time, deal with a kind of second escalation of the Cold War, because the late 60s and the almost entire 70s were so-called détente.
This is Alexei Golubev, a PhD student of history at UBC. I spoke with him mid-November at a bustling coffee shop to gain some accredited knowledge about the relations between the United States and the Soviet Union during the 1980s.
By the late 70s, there is a growing mistrust between the Soviet Union and the United States. And it's interesting because both sides were interpreting themselves as primarily defensive. So neither would admit that they would act as an aggressor, but both rather feared that they would be an object of aggression, an object of attack. In this sense, what we see in the 1980s is kind of result of mutual misunderstanding.
And so there was a great buildup of defensive arms on both sides in the 1980s.
And the reason for that buildup was that both sides feared that the other side would gain a strategic advantage and would try to use this strategic advantage in order to attack. So in the 1980s until late 80s, tensions were on the rise. And allegedly in 1983, during one of NATO operations, the tension among the Soviet leaders was so high that Virchil Andropov had his finger on the red button.
The specific historical event Alexei is referring to here.
Allegedly in 1983, during one of NATO operations,
is what is known as the Able Archer operation. It is arguably the closest the world has ever gotten to an all-out nuclear war. Next to the Cuban Missile Crisis, that is. Here's what happened.
The lead-up to it was after Reagan's election in 1980. He had taken on quite bellicose rhetoric versus the Soviet Union, and he had promised a military buildup.
This is Professor Arjun Chowdhury. He is a political science professor at UBC that specializes in issues of international security. Professor Chowdhury explains how badly shaken the sense of security was for both the U.S. and the USSR because of misunderstandings and misperceptions during the Able Archer operation.
So what happened in 1983 was the Soviets were quite worried about the possibility of some kind of military attack. And in 1983, a standard NATO exercise called Able Archer went into play in Eastern Europe. And the Soviets misperceived it as a possible first strike. And they stepped up their alertness level to a very high degree. And at least on the Soviet side, there was some fear that this was the prelude to an all-out attack. It took a while for the Soviets to understand that this is actually just a military exercise.
How did they understand that?
We are not entirely sure as of now. But they stood down their forces. And it took even longer for the Americans to realize that, oh, the Soviets were serious. So this was a case of possible escalation through misunderstanding, misperception. Because what the Americans and NATO thought was just an exercise, the Soviets thought might be a preliminary strike. And they stepped up their alertness levels. So that and Cuba are said to be the closest to nuclear confrontation that happened in the Cold War.
Because state relations were this dangerously packed with suspicions and fears, so too was the outlook of ordinary citizens in Vancouver. Consider listening to a speaker talk about the aftermath of a nuclear bomb hitting Vancouver City. Would you feel uncomfortable? Scared? That is exactly what Australian peace activist Helen Caldicott did back in November of 1983 during a presentation on the UBC campus.
What I'm going to do now is drop a bomb on this tent here. And it'll come in over treetop level. You won't even see it coming. And then it will explode with the heat of the sun. The heat of the sun. It will dig a hole right here, 3/4 of a mile wide and 800 feet deep. And it'll turn all of us and all the campus and the earth below to radioactive fallout, which we will be shot up in the mushroom cloud up into the stratosphere. So we'll just turn up into radioactive molecules. And out to a radius of 6 miles from here, in all directions, every building will be flattened, every person killed, but many of them will be vaporized. And in Hiroshima, there are photographs of shadows of people. That's all that was left of them, shadows. Out to 20 miles from here, in all directions, every person will be killed or lethally injured. Now, the injuries are specific. Winds are created of up to 500 miles an hour. A hurricane is 120 miles an hour. The winds just literally pick people up and turn them into rockets, missiles, traveling at 100 miles an hour till they hit the nearest solid object and die. The overpressures enter the nose and mouth and get into the lungs and rupture the lungs. You're dead. They rupture the tympanic membranes, producing deafness. They popcorn the windows, and the windows then fracture into millions of shards of flying glass at 100 miles an hour, which will decapitate people and produce the most shocking lacerations and hemorrhage everywhere. Then the burns.
Helen goes on and does not spare the audience one single gruesome detail. For us, this explanation most likely does not strike as much fear and genuine anxiety as it would have to those physically present during that presentation back in 1983. In fact, Min Price and Jocelyn Sampson, hosts of a CITR radio talk show called Youth Focus, featured a segment in 1984 entitled Youth and the Peace Movement. Take a listen.
In BC, Susan Hargraves, a researcher for the Public Educators for Peace Society, has paralleled the American studies. In June 1984, Ms. Hargraves distributed questionnaires to 730 Burnaby students in grades 5, 7, and 9 through 12. Of the responding students, 80% fear nuclear death. Of the 5th through 9th graders, more than 92% had known of nuclear weapons by age 13. 79% believe that a nuclear war will occur in their lifetime. Although it is uncertain what effect the threat of nuclear disaster is having on young people, the implications are obvious. Feelings of despair and anger contribute to a reluctance to form close relationships, work hard in school, and plan for the future.
To bring these figures and numbers into a more personal perspective, I talked to Alan Sens, another professor at the University of British Columbia in the Department of Political Science. He was a student at UBC from the years 1982 to 1988, and he described for me what it was like attending UBC in the 1980s.
There was a great deal of fear, a great deal of concern. It was the great existential concern of the day. There really was a sense that a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union was, if not highly likely, it was certainly a possibility. And there was even some deep pessimism about the future. Remember, this is 1980s. This is the arrival of Ronald Reagan onto the scene in the United States and what some have called the Second Cold War. That followed after a period of relatively stable, reasonable relations between the United States and the Soviet Union. That all seemed to go downhill in the 1980s with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and subsequent increase in rhetoric, an increase in the arms race, development of new weapons systems that were considered destabilizing and threatening. So students really felt that. Even students, I think, that really weren't engaged in the peace movement it was sort of an overall mood of fear about the direction the Cold War was heading, and a feeling that a war was perhaps more likely than it had been since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Naturally, such intense fear fed into an intense desire for change. Due to the pervasive prevalence of nuclear weapons in the hands of the two most powerful nations in the world, and the anxiety that was attached to them given contentious foreign relations, Vancouver peace activists during the 1980s agreed that the nuclear arms buildup needed to be stopped. Thus, the backdrop to the advocacy campaign that was the peace movement, at least here in Vancouver during the 1980s, was a pervasive public mood of anxiety and fear. Part 2, the debate over deterrence. Peace activists, galvanized behind the advocacy campaign dedicated to seeing a complete disposal of all nuclear arsenal. However, in the 1980s, such a prospect went directly against the defense policies held by the superpowers. The arms race between the U.S. and the Soviet Union during the 1980s was based upon the theory of deterrence, and more specific to the Cold War, a doctrine of mutually assured destruction. Before getting into deterrence theory, first we take a deeper look into mutually assured destruction. Alexei Golubov.
The doctrine of the mutual assured destruction means that if there is a war, this is a kind of war that is impossible to win, because both sides had so great nuclear arsenals that even a first strike wouldn't give an advantage to any side. That's why, for instance, one of the important treaties signed in the 1980s was the treaty that explicitly banned the creation of anti-missile systems.
Anti-missile systems?
So, a system of interceptor missiles that would allow, in theory, to intercept nuclear missiles, nuclear ballistic missiles, and never let them reach the American continent, for example. If you have an effectively functioning anti-missile system, it means that the doctrine of the mutual assured destruction no longer works. It means that you might think, as a strategic analyst in Washington or wherever, that you might strike first and intercept rockets launched in retaliation. And in this sense, the possession of this kind of anti-missile system would undermine this doctrine. And this doctrine has been fundamental kind of force that prevented any military engagement between the American and Soviet forces during the Cold War. It was perhaps the most important kind of impeding factor, the factor that never led the Third World War to break out.
As Alexei pointed out, mutually assured destruction ensured that the U.S. would not risk a nuclear strike on the Soviet Union for fear of a retaliatory nuclear attack. For both the U.S. and the Soviet Union, it was their capabilities in firepower that they relied upon to scare and deter the other from attacking. Trying to dissuade another state from a particular course of action with threats, like a nuclear attack, is what deterrence is. Deterrence is the underlying concept behind mutually assured destruction. To help us in our understanding of deterrence, Professor Chowdhury provides a helpful analogy.
Think of two people, right? And this is the logic thrown out in the U.S. to defend the carrying of weapons. If somebody just has their fists, you become more likely to provoke them, to fight with them. Why? Because there's limited damage they can inflict on you. Now, if they have a gun, you're very unlikely to confront them. You're very unlikely to rob someone who has a gun compared to the same person who's unarmed. So the basic idea here is that if the weapons are very destructive, the costs of war are very high. Nuclear weapons raise the cost of war to unimaginable levels. And therefore, that should make people think twice before fighting. So that's why you think of deterrence working. Why? Because the costs of war are so high that people don't want to fight. They're better off talking to each other and figuring out a bargain that saves themselves the cost of fighting.
Right.
Now, if you disarm, yeah, you may not have nuclear weapons, but that means the costs of war are not very high. If the costs of war are not high, then you become more likely to get into border disputes. You get more likely to get into smaller conflicts, which can then escalate to something bigger. But if you think that, oh my God, there's a possibility that if stuff gets out of hand, there'll be a nuclear weapon landing on one of our cities, you don't get into the initial fight.
This wasn't a very popular understanding back in the 1980s, right?
So there was debate. I'll put this way. There was much more debate over it than there is now. Now it's kind of taken for granted. It's taken for granted that, yeah, you should have a general level of stability with your deterrence. And that's because we think, oh, the more costly war is, the less likely. The other concern that was there, though, was also that what happens in case of accidental nuclear war. And certainly this theory does not give us much comfort for that. For example, if, say, you have some kind of error, some kind of misperception, and you have a nuclear exchange, then things can get out of hand very quickly. And if that happens, then the cost of war, even when neither side wants to fight it, will be unacceptably high. And through the Cold War, that was a quite reasonable fear, because most of your confrontations had a fair amount of misperception and error. You think of the Cuban Missile Crisis, you think of the exercise in 1983 called Able Archer. So that was another fear, which is less of a fear now.
Thus, regardless of how effective we accept deterrence to be now in preventing large-scale, high-cost wars, deterrence was, like it still is today, vulnerable to fail through human error. This concern was simply magnified to a higher degree because the consequences of a mere fluke or slight mishap among the Soviet and U.S. generals during the Cold War was this: nuclear Armageddon. Nothing more, nothing less. As Professor Chowdhury pointed out, such flukes and mishaps were not at all that far-fetched, given events like the Cuban Missile Crisis and Able Archer. So, let's summarize. Bigger guns means less conflict, but especially in the case of the Cold War, bigger guns also meant harsher consequences if anything goes wrong. And so the debate lies in whether or not states should keep the big guns to avoid the big risks, understanding that getting rid of the big guns would lead to less risk, but also more conflict. Confused? You're not alone.
Few things have as much complexity as arms control.
If Professor Sens, who has a profession in teaching topics like this, says it's a complex topic, it's a complex topic. Part 3, The Dialogue Within the Peace Movement. Do we overhaul a seemingly unreliable system of deterrence and mutually assured destruction, or do we keep faith and just pray the odds are in our favor? Are there ways to partially improve the unstable circumstances of the Cold War? It is these questions that were being thrown back and forth in the 6th General Assembly of the World Council of Churches in November 1983. A range of peace activists from all over the globe, including Randolph Forsberg, John Hadgood, Helen Caldicott, and Metropolitan Gregoris, gathered at the University of British Columbia to talk about what needed to be done.
The first step, as you might guess, is a nuclear freeze. The very first thing that we need to do to begin the process of moving toward a stable, disarmed peace is to stop producing counterforce nuclear weaponry, which is designed to back up conventional wars, while those conventional wars themselves are not defensive wars, but interventionary wars. This is clearly the most absurd, insecure, imposing construction of weaponry and type of military strategy there could be, that we should draw the nuclear tripwire tighter by building nuclear forces designed to attack conventional military forces, putting pressure on the two sides, both to use their forces or lose them. That is the first thing that must be stopped.
There has to be some system of deterrence in the world, whether this is nuclear or not. So we do not escape from the problem of deterrence by saying that we do not like nuclear weapons. And it seems to me that the fruitful question in this area is not how can we get rid of this or that, but how can we make deterrence it more stable? But we have to face the fact that there must be some deterrence.
Britain's got nuclear weapons. Why on earth Britain has them, I don't know. I think she still wants to be a great empire and can't understand why she isn't. And then India's tested one, and South Africa's almost certainly got one, and they say Israel has about 200. And so that's called lateral proliferation of nuclear weapons, which destabilizes the balance of terror built up by the superpowers. And by the year 2000, there'll be many, many countries who can have nuclear weapons. The only way to stop it is for the superpowers to start behaving themselves. They signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1968, promising that if no one else built nuclear weapons, they would start to disarm bilaterally. And they've done exactly the opposite. They can't police the world. They have no moral leg to stand on without behaving responsibly like adults themselves, and they behave like children.
We have agreed that the use of nuclear weapons is a crime against humanity. Everybody is agreed. We say, if the the other speakers, like President Reagan and Menachem Begin, who spoke in the assembly, wouldn't oppose that. But if the use of nuclear weapons is morally evil, then the intention to use is also morally evil. And therefore, the doctrine of deterrence is not morally acceptable. This is the position which Philip Potter has taken, and which I think the World Council Central Committee has taken in the general debate that has ensued. But whether the Assembly will also take that position is one of the key issues. But this would mean that we condemn not only use, intention to use, but also manufacture, stockpiling, testing, all the rest, trading. All these will have to be condemned as morally evil.
About a year after this assembly was held, Vancouver peace activists of the younger generation spoke freely on CITR's Youth Focus program. They spoke specifically on the obstacles to youth involvement in the peace movement. 17-year-old Nedjo Rogers, graduate of Vancouver's Ideal School.
Lots of my friends and lots of people have talked to you about nightmares about nuclear war. I think part of that is due to the fact that for quite a few years now, the peace movement has concentrated on filling people in on the dangers of nuclear war, which is good because it mobilizes people and it gets people aware of what's going on. But it has to be followed up by a means to take action, and that, I think, has been lacking. There have been annual peace marches and stuff like that, but there hasn't been the constant opportunity to take action, which is needed to relieve people of a feeling of, like, sort of a oppressive feeling that there's nothing they can do and that there's things above their heads. So they haven't been taught to take personal responsibility or to take personal action, and that's something that people have to be taught, and they have to realize that if things are going to happen, they have to do them.
Jennifer Kinlock, member of Vancouver's Youth for Peace Action.
Well, it's really important not to be daunted by the information and sort of say, oh, I don't know enough, I can't get involved. The peace movement needs more and more people and more new and fresh energy to get involved so that we can be effective, and that once you do get involved, you begin to realize what you do know, what you don't know, where your strengths lie. And many groups, including Vancouver Youth for Peace Action, have bibliographies which shorten those long lists of things that you have to read and get informed about, so that there are shortcuts. And in speaking with people who are informed in the peace movement and going to public events, it makes the process of becoming more informed that much easier.
Matthew Spire, treasurer of the Peace Education Coalition.
When there are models, namely parents who are involved or concerned, those children usually show some interest and some concern themselves. However, most parents are not involved in this. In fact, many parents, I don't know how many, what percentage, but many parents choose not to think about it. They push it out of their consciousness, and they engage in what Robert J. Lifton, the Harvard psychiatrist, has called psychic numbing. They allow themselves to be numbed because of the anxiety which this kind of a problem creates. And examples of that would be a parent saying, well, let's not talk about that. It's too horrible to talk about. Oh, let's not even consider that as a conversation item. Let's change the subject. In other words, there's a real concern to avoid considering the issue. I think there are a lot of adults who are in those shoes. I think that's an obstacle.
From obstacles ranging from apathy to feelings of overwhelm, Vancouver youths face many challenges getting involved with the peace movement during the 1980s. However, a common motivation that drove youths to join and galvanize behind the peace movement was a frustration and a growing sense of distrust in political figures. 23-year-old Chris Corless, member of UBC's Students for Mutual Peace and Disarmament, speaking on Youth Focus.
This is at UBC. I just happened to be walking through the Student Union building, and they had a display set up. And I guess the issue had been in the back of my mind that, you know, a lot of these headlines were in the papers, and I was a little concerned, and I just started walking through this display, and I guess the thing that moved me the most was one quote. I believe it was by General Graham, who just happened to pass through Vancouver quite recently, promoting the Star Wars proposal. And there's a quote by attributed to him where he was saying that the people had nothing to worry about if a nuclear bomb hit, is that all they had to do was just, you know, it would just take 5 minutes to walk to the nearest lilac bush, and they could hide behind it, and they would be protected against nuclear bomb. I found it just so ludicrous and so incredible, and yet that scared me, because here was a man who was in very strong influence in policymaking and so on. And it made me realize, I guess, that a lot of these people who are in the decision-making process and who are making the decisions affecting our present time and also our future lives, here was a man who really didn't understand the issue. I knew that the effects of nuclear bombs were just so incredible that millions of lilac bushes couldn't protect you. Young people must come to understand that you cannot trust in experts, and unfortunately you cannot trust in our representatives, the politicians. Many of the politicians are not very well informed on the issues. I don't mean to really strongly criticize them and say they're a bunch of bumbling idiots and that sort of thing, but I understand their viewpoint, in that a politician, for example, becomes elected and he's elected on a number of issues, and he has to concern himself with a number of issues, and there's just so much information that many politicians do not have the time and the energy and the effort to inform themselves on the issues, and so they have to rely on other experts. But often they make the decisions based on being misinformed. So I think it's very important for youth to become involved and gradually become informed of the issues and make the decisions for themselves and start becoming involved in the democratic process. No one else is going to do it for them. They have to do it themselves.
Someone who would wholeheartedly agree with Chris's views is Australian peace activist Helen Caldicott. She is the one who spoke at UBC during the World Council of Churches 6th General Assembly and said this.
What I'm going to do now is drop a bomb on this tent here, and it'll come in over treetop level. You won't even see it coming.
And this.
Britain's got nuclear weapons. Why on earth Britain has them, I don't know. I think she still wants to be a great empire.
And also this.
I spent an hour and a quarter with President Reagan, alone with his daughter. He's not very bright. I say that because clinically, as a physician, it worries me immensely. Because the two people in America who have the authority to press the button are called the National Command Authority, the NCA. They are the President and the Secretary of Defense. I think the Secretary of Defense's IQ is a little higher than Reagan's, but he doesn't know very much about defense. In fact, a reporter from the LA Times went to Bechtel, where Weinberger used to work. You know, Bechtel builds nuclear reactors. And he interviewed George Shultz and Caspar Weinberger. And both of them independently said, you can ask me anything you like, but don't ask me about foreign affairs or about defense, because I don't know anything about those subjects. So we're in the hands of incompetent people who don't know anything. I repeat, who don't know anything. Practically everything that President Reagan told me was inaccurate. And when I tried to correct him, he didn't really hear. And when I tried to debate with him, he had no background knowledge to support any statement he made. And he is the person who, if there's a nuclear war, is going to run to the helicopter, fly to Andrews Air Force Base, and then go up in the airborne command and fly in an aeroplane above the nuclear war as the explosions are taking place underneath and direct the nuclear war by computers. He said the other day he doesn't understand anything about computers. He doesn't. He's never done any science. Can you imagine? That man has 4.5 billion people in the palm of his hand. I was there on the day the MX was defeated last year. And in the halls of the Congress, the Pentagon had 1,500 lobbyists. There were lobbyists from Raytheon, Rockwell International, GTE, Sylvania, all making parts of the weapons, and lots of subcontractors who make screws for the MX and all sorts of things. The halls were full of these characters. They were like ants. I felt like bopping them on the head because they were medically contraindicated. Where were the people? Where were the people and their children? They weren't there. Why weren't they there? Because they're very comfortable. And all they care about is driving their cars and getting their air conditioning going. And I'm not talking about you, but the majority of people in the United States are like that. They don't give a damn. They don't even vote. Now, you don't have a democracy unless you vote. You don't have a democracy unless you accept responsibility. And there is not a working democracy. People in other countries are dying to have a democracy. In Afghanistan, right? South Africa, El Salvador, all over the world. And we've got one, and we violate it. All of us. All of us.
Helen Caldicott was arguably the most outspoken and internationally recognized peace activist within the peace movement of the 1980s. She featured in an Oscar-winning short film called If You Love This Planet. She's been awarded 21 honorary doctoral degrees and was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. I had the honor of speaking with Helen Caldicott over Skype this past November.
Here we are.
Hi, I apologize. I do not actually have a webcam on me. Would it be all right if we...
Absolutely. I'll turn the picture off because we'll get a better reception. Okay, let's go.
Our conversation progressed more smoothly after that slight technical difficulty, and I started off by asking her about what initially got her involved in the peace movement.
I was practicing global preventive medicine. I went to Russia in 1979 with a group of Americans, Quakers, and I learned that America was going to deploy cruise missiles in Europe, which are undetectable and would end arms control by satellite verification. And the Americans were going to deploy Pershing 2 missiles in Germany that hit Moscow in 3 minutes. And I thought, my God, I just can't. And I went back to Harvard where I was on the faculty. And I thought, I just can't keep practicing individual medicine, keeping these children with cystic fibrosis alive when all of the world's children are at risk of nuclear war. That's when I was impelled to leave Harvard and to work full-time on this political work to practice global preventive medicine to save all the children on the planet.
It was that realization.
Yes, it was. That was the turning point for me. During the 80s, I led the peace movement, with the help of a publicist in Hollywood who put me on lots of television for free. and work for me for free, and in Vogue and Life and Time. If you educate the public, that's political power. And when I started in 1978, most Americans said it's better to be dead than red. In other words, they'd rather be dead in a nuclear war than be communist. And I thought, these people are psychotic. So we started describing, you know, what a nuclear war meant for their health, dropping bombs on cities. And they said, oh, my God, nuclear war is bad for our health. So from that time on, they became involved and they learnt. And so to get 80% of people behind you is enormous political power. And we're in, and I would always quote President Jefferson in America to say, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. So I would postulate or state that your democracy is totally uninformed about this enormous danger to the end of creation, as is America and every other country in the world.
The danger Helen is talking about here is the persistent threat of nuclear annihilation that Helen believes has not diminished in urgency in the least.
The risk of nuclear war now is more pertinent than it ever was during the Cold War.
Really?
Because of two things. A, nobody knows that the weapons are still on hair trigger alert, ready to be launched with a 3-minute decision time by Clinton, by Putin or Obama. And B, because no one knows. And C, because for the first time since the Cold War, America and Russia are now confronting each other militarily, both in the Ukraine and in Syria, and they're practicing nuclear war games, and they've probably put their nuclear weapons on a higher than normal state of alert. Things are really, really serious, and no one's talking about it, including your politicians, including Trudeau.
It does almost seem as though deterrence has been working in...
No, it hasn't. If we have a nuclear war, there's going to be no one around to write and say deterrence didn't work. We've just been bloody lucky. Bloody lucky to have got to this stage. If you read the literature, Christine, and you should do that, you'll be amazed at the number of close calls we've had, you know, to within minutes of pressing a button. I don't, honestly, and I've done that history and I've written about it in my book. I can't remember what it's called.
You did
The New Nuclear Danger, yes. I mean, if you look at the history, I really don't understand how we're still here. I don't. Right. I don't understand how we're still here.
Right. So it's not an improvement until all nuclear weapons have been disarmed.
Yeah.
Right. It's total nuclear disarmament.
Yeah.
I was surprised to hear Helen speak so strongly about the need for a commitment to total nuclear disarmament then and more significantly now. If the peace movement died away, even though the issues that propelled it to be still remained, did that mean Helen thought of the peace movement as a failure? Do you think that the peace movement has failed?
Yes.
Part 4, Why the Peace Movement Failed.
Yes, why? Because there's no peace movement now, Christine.
Right.
The peace movement died in 1989 when the Cold War ended, and everyone dropped their bundle because we thought, obviously, that the nuclear powers would get rid of the weapons, and they haven't. We thought, I mean, we really did think, all of us, and the people in America were talking about a peace dividend and instead of spending all this money on weapons, we'll spend it on peace. But, you know, we had gutless leaders and they didn't do that and take up the cudgel of peace. And so here we are now. That's what the problem is. Because nobody knows that the situation is more dangerous now than ever before. Yes, the peace movement died. There is virtually no peace movement now in the world.
For Helen Caldicott, the peace movement that she heralded with vigor and passion was a failure. It was a failure because it died away prematurely, in her view, and without having achieved its goals. Professor Alan Sens echoes the fact that with the Cold War having ended by the early 1990s, nuclear arms control was a topic simply not on the minds of the public as pervasively any longer.
It's just not as prominent an issue. We could argue that it should be, but it's just not. So right away, I think a key difference is that you don't have the same amount of focus on nuclear weapons today as you did back in the 1980s. The fear, the threat of nuclear war is lower now, dramatically lower, at least in a North American context, than it was during the Cold War. So I think that's a big initial piece. I think there's also been a great deal of neglect on the subject of nuclear weapons. And as a result, I think the dialogue on nuclear weapons today is much more basic than it was in the 1980s, because during the 1980s, even if you weren't interested in nuclear weapons were interested in you, right? It was just everyone had some basic idea about what deterrence was and how nuclear war, what it would mean, and so on. And now there's just less of that background level of knowledge. So you're starting, I think, at a lower baseline of basic knowledge for the most part amongst today's population. It's not just students. That's broadly speaking, I think that's the case. So I think that in that way, the dialogue has changed. I think also with the decline in the immediacy of the threat of nuclear war, I think what we've seen is a bit of diffusion of the dialogue on arms control. So the big arms control discussions over the last 10 to 20 years after the Cold War has been proliferation.
The topic of discussion around nuclear weapons today has changed, like Professor Sen said. To Professor Arjun Chowdhury, the discussion has changed quite significantly. Before explaining his perspective on exactly what the topics of discussion are surrounding nuclear weapons today, Professor Chowdhury first elaborates on two major differences between now and the 1980s. One of these differences, contrary to Helen Caldicott's beliefs, asserts the efficacy of deterrence.
You couldn't think of two broad differences between now and the 1980s. The first is that we've had another 30 years of nuclear non-use. And there's some reason to believe that, or some evidence for the proposition, that nuclear deterrence stops people fighting. The link between nuclear weapons and war is much less direct than people assumed in the late 70s, early 80s. And at the time, people thought that the Cold War won't end unless it ends in a war, actual shooting war. But it turned out the Soviet Union folded for quite different reasons, and deterrence was not breached. Deterrence worked. So that'd be one reason, the argument that nuclear deterrence works. The second is the idea that the people you want to give up nuclear weapons are very unlikely to give them up. So disarmament, unilateral disarmament, is really not going to help much. Because now the concern is that a regime like that of Kim Jong-un in North Korea, and even if the United States gives up nuclear weapons, it's very unlikely that Kim Jong-un would reciprocate. The idea of disarmament in the Cold War was to get both sides to disarm. That it is quite clear that even if the United States and China and Russia disarms, North Korea will not give up its nuclear weapons.
Right.
It's quite clear that if India disarms, Pakistan is very unlikely to give up its nuclear weapons. So disarmament is not a solution for the problem of nuclear war that it was seen to be in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And secondly, going back to my first point, it is not clear that disarmament in the abstract is a solution for war. Deterrence can quite easily work to prevent war.
To add to these two points, Professor Chowdhury elaborates on the biggest fears surrounding nuclear weapons today, and how none of these current fears can be adequately dealt with through a policy of nuclear disarmament.
There's two issues that people are worried about. One is the escalation of existing regional conflicts, the Korean Peninsula. If you get into a shooting war, that might escalate to a nuclear war. South Asia, India and Pakistan might escalate to a nuclear war. So that's fear one, regional conflicts going nuclear. Fear two is proliferation and nuclear weapons winding up in the hands of non-state actors. So that would be something like a nuclear weapon goes missing or is sold to Al-Qaeda, ISIS, somebody like that. And then that is used, it could be a small weapon, but that is used by terrorists in a major urban center, which would obviously inflict tens of thousands of fatalities. So those are the two major nuclear fears. And again, you can see that disarmament is unlikely to bring the odds of either of those down. Because disarmament, that is getting the people who are likely to use or proliferate nuclear weapons, to give up the nuclear weapons they have, that is your Kim Jong-un or the government in Pakistan, is very low. Even if everyone else says we will give up our nuclear weapons, those regimes are unlikely to. And those regimes are also seen as the most likely sources of proliferation. The current concerns of regional war going nuclear and nuclear proliferation are unlikely to be addressed by disarmament.
Thus, part of the reason why the peace movement dissipated is firstly because interest by state leaders and the general public declined dramatically with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. Additionally, however, the actual issues surrounding nuclear weapons today has shifted away from nuclear disarmament as a credible solution. That being said, simply because the peace movement subsided does not mean that the value of the impact the peace movement had then cannot be recognized and felt now. The peace movement in Vancouver contributed to the larger international peace movement of the 1980s, and this larger international peace movement was a major source of pressure for the Reagan administration in trying to find peaceful, diplomatic ways to resolve the Cold War. Take a listen to this clip from Youth Focus.
Is the peace movement making a difference? Those involved see the movement as having helped to raise the level of public consciousness concerning the nuclear threat. And in turn, this public awareness has been effective in educating, pressuring, and changing the policies of government representatives. Chris Corliss.
There have been government officials who have credited the peace movement as pressuring, for example, the superpowers back to the bargaining table. For pressuring, for example, the Reagan administration to initially go to the bargaining table in Geneva in 1981, I believe it was, or 82. When he first came in, they were totally against arms control. Actually, many people in the administration still are against arms control. They didn't even want to even talk. But the peace movement put a lot of pressure on the Reagan administration, and he realized that a lot of people were concerned about it. And now he has begun to address these issues, and I think he's developed himself in that he's changed in a way in realizing that a lot of people are very concerned. And I think that it has been quite effective.
Along the same lines, Alexei Golubov reflects upon the integral context the global peace movement gave to negotiations between the Reagan and Gorbachev governments during the 1980s.
I think that was an important context of decision-making in the United States. In the case of protest movements, we saw the ability of societies, Western societies, to organize themselves in the ways that were not entirely predicted or initiated by the government. So the protest movement was a form of social self-organization. And as a form of social self-organization, it pursued very different aims from those that were on the political agenda, at least for conservative politicians. In this sense, and since we are dealing with participatory politics, those political opinions, those political sentiments had to be taken into account. So I am not sure if like Thatcher or Reagan would refer to these peace movements like openly, but I would say that as like democratic leaders, that was their that wasn't their electorate, but that was their populations, right? And they had to find, to look for compromises. In the sense, the reason why Reagan was so eager to meet Gorbachev, well, it wouldn't be the course. Protest movements would not be the course, but they were the context for that. In this sense, we can speculate that if it hadn't been for these like sorts of marches and protests and demonstrations, the negotiation process would have probably been much more complicated, or at least more reluctant.
Of course, with the dissolution of the USSR in 1991, the need for constant pressure on the US government to make peace with the USSR was no longer there. However, there is something to be said to the impact the peace movement had in pressuring great powers like the US towards peaceful negotiation in the first place. Such an impact, only seen when considering the historical context that the peace movement gave for the 1980s, is a testament to what self-mobilized grassroots movements can achieve. Oftentimes, as citizens of a representative government, we can undervalue the democratic freedoms we have to protest by underestimating the impact our protests can make. This idea is perhaps no more appreciated than when you consider the alternative of inaction. Professor Chowdhury.
I'm from India, and I was in India when the nuclear testing occurred, but, in 1998. And overall, there was not anything like the kind of peace movement. There were some objections, but they were marginal. And this despite the fact that nuclear weapons in India do not add to Indian security in any way. It just led to Pakistan nuclearizing faster, and nuclear weapons in Pakistan are very dangerous for India. If something goes wrong, it's right on India's border.
So that was kind of like a bad choice by the state.
It was a tremendously bad choice by the Indian government. They gained nothing. They already had a conventional advantage. What they achieved was just to raise the odds that some kind of horrible accident is going to get visited on India.
So should the protests have been greater?
There should have been more, but you had very marginal protests. And if you look back 17 years, all that they've achieved, they've not gained anything in terms of changing Pakistan policy by getting nuclear weapons. If anything, they've just emboldened Pakistan to support these non-state actors that they've frequently been supporting. And there's nothing the Indian government can do about it. It can build as many nuclear weapons as it wants. It has about 100, give or take. But they're useless. So, this was a really bad decision, and it did not see anything like the popular opposition that it should have. So I'm not seeing the kind of popular opposition to nuclearization that the 80s might have led to. It's almost like the sentiment of the 1980s ended there. And certainly in a place like India, India doesn't need nuclear. But, there was no opposition. There were few protests in the street. But one of the protesters, Arundhati Roy, who's a wonderful writer, she's the author of The God of Small Things, she was shouted down in a public meeting where she was saying this is a bad idea. And she made a very valid point that India has all kinds of development issues, poverty, farmer debt, etc. And this is a complete waste of resources for the government of India, which is a valid point, but it was not a point that a lot of people supported, which in my view is unfortunate, but that's where it was. There was nothing like the peace movement. So, I wish there was more scrutiny of more sort of people in the street trying to get things spent properly, and the nuclear weapons are a part of that. So yeah, that's I think the peace movement is not directly relevant for India, but something.
So kind of the spirit behind the peace movement.
Therein lies the need for movements just like the peace movement. Movements to wake and galvanize people of a democratic nation towards action. It is these movements that will paint the backdrop to a nation's decisions in the short and long run.
It is these movements that are the defining markers of a democratic people and state. The success in the peace movement of the 1980s here in Vancouver lies in the very fact that regardless of outcome, it was and remains to this day an emblem of self-mobilized political activism. The only true failure there could have been for it is if it had not been at all. Thank you for listening to The Peace Movement, the beginning and end of nuclear disarmament campaigning in Vancouver. A documentary produced for CITR's An Audio Evolution of UBC. This documentary could not have been made without the help of the following individuals and organizations: Helen Caldicott, Arjun Chowdhury, Alexei Golubov, David Marquay, Alan Sens, Madeline Taylor, the Girls in Monday Carry Corps, CITR Radio, and finally, the UBC Centennial Initiative. Music for this documentary is sourced from the soundtrack of the movie The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
You've just been listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc series. We would like to thank UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund, Peter Doolin, Emily Morgan, Shyla Seller, and Katie Harris for researching, digitizing, and cataloging our archive tape. Thanks to Robert and Bronwyn at the UBC Library Digitization Center for partnering with us to digitize, launch, and host the audio collection. And Erwin at the UBC University Archives, thank you to Nardwar the Human Serbiet and to Madeline Taylor for organizing this project and supporting our documentary producers.
And visit our website, citr.ca/docs, for podcasts, interviews with the producers, and more information.